Welcome back to Camera Conversations with your host Colin Campbell, and today is a special solo recording to celebrate hitting the milestone of 250 episodes. I have collated the range of moments, insights and lessons that stand out to me from the brilliant guests I've had over the last 250 episodes, and what a bank of episodes and guests I've been able to choose from. It's been quite a journey we've been on over 4 years since the first episode in the 1st of April 2020, and we have not slowed down. I've poured an awful lot into the last 250 episodes. It's been almost 300 hours of recording, or 18,000 minutes. And there's a lot of time that goes in behind the scenes to create what you guys get to enjoy on a weekly basis, from contacting guests, scheduling, the deep research for which my podcast and my interview style is known, the editing, the publishing, the social media promotion and getting out and sharing it, and even the interacting with you guys over the DMs, which I thoroughly enjoy so much. It's been a huge project for me, and I've learned an awful lot along the way, and I hope you have too. I've picked just 15 lessons to share with you today, and those come from a huge variety of guests, including Sahil Bloom, Chris Williamson, Richard Dixon, Dr. Julie Gerner, and many more. And I want to say a thank you for your part in the last 250 episodes, whether you're somebody that's new here, whether you're somebody that's listened to a few episodes, whether you're someone that dips in and out of the show, or whether you're somebody that's been here since day one, listening to everything that's been put out there. I appreciate you and the role that you've played in getting to this milestone. If you would like to help me celebrate that milestone, I want to ask that you make sure you've hit the subscribe or the follow button on whatever platform you're listening on. And I'm going to ask that you take the time to copy and paste the link to your favorite episode from the last 250 and share it with a friend, or post it to your Instagram story and tag me at col.cambro, or share it to your LinkedIn feed and tag me at Colin T. Campbell. The support doesn't go unnoticed, and I'm working really hard to keep bringing you the best possible episodes, the best possible guests, and really produce at the highest quality. And I've invested really heavily again in the last week. I've been out in Dubai doing another 3 episodes. So I can promise you we're not slowing down. I appreciate every ounce of support you've given me, and we're going to keep going at full pace. Let's go. Today's podcast is sponsored and supported by Vibe. If you're anything like me and you're pursuing peak performance, then Vibe is the brand to support you. They are at the cutting edge of nutrition and peak performance with 3 of their hero products. The first is the Hero All-in-One Meal Prep Shake. It replaces a meal, it saves you time, saves you money, and it also includes the extra ingredient of lion's mane mushroom powder for all things focus, as well as all the normal things you'd expect in terms of a high protein content and nutrients. The second of those is their greens powder, which, best believe, you and I all know that you're not having enough fruit and vegetables, and neither am I, so having a greens powder on a daily basis is a bit of a game changer. It covers all my bases, and it also tastes great as well. I don't know about you, but every other greens powder I've tried has made me want to be sick, but the pineapple from Vibe is a personal favorite, but there's another couple of flavors available too. And third, and by no means least, is my new favorite. It is the Brain Care Smart Focus. It includes a number of different mushroom ingredients, which I take to enable me to do my deep work and my focus. It has around 40 milligrams of caffeine, so it's not super high in caffeine, so I can even have it in the afternoon and it won't disrupt my flow and my sleep before bed, but gets me into a state of deep work where I can work on the things that I care about and push forward. Vibe will be linked in the show notes at vibe.co.uk, and you can use the code CAMBRO for 15% off to shop today. Welcome to episode 250 of the podcast, and what a journey it's been. So much learned along the way, and as a way of marking this occasion, it's time for me to sit down and share some of my favorite lessons, insights and quotes from the variety of guests that I've interviewed since starting recording back in April 2020. This is mostly going to cover the big themes of the podcast, and that is improving mind and body, business and finances, and living an aligned and focused life. So let's start off with one for the mind, and it's a lesson from Dr. Arya. He said, "I don't know any growth without suffering. We've been institutionalized in modern society for the delightful parts of life are good and the painful, destructive parts are bad. And it isn't the case, because they're both two different sides of the same coin. You can't have victory without challenges. You can't have courage without despair. You can't have joy without sorrows." It's something that other guests have touched on as well, and regular roundtable guest David Hatt has spoken about appreciating the highs and the success because of the weeks where things just aren't going right. You're feeling low, you're feeling tired, you're feeling sluggish, you're feeling less motivated. And that's why when you feel on a high, you genuinely do feel that elation and you feel great because it's not normal. It's not the standard. We as humans will only appreciate this spectrum of emotions that we're going to have, and we must be ready to handle all of them, and certainly both sides of that coin. Aria explained to me how the mind has evolved to follow three principles. It wants to seek pleasure, it wants to avoid pain, and it wants to conserve energy. This is our evolutionary programming. We can't escape what has built us over these years. And our task is now to see the mind as a tool and not to attach too much to it. We have to appreciate as well that I've spoken to so many psychologists over the last 4 years, one of them, Dr. Meg Jay, and she explained that our brain is there to keep us alive, not necessarily to keep us happy. Priority number one is for us to continue our longevity and our lifespan, not to live this happy-go-lucky, exciting existence. In the episode, Aria encouraged me to transcend the mind and create distance from our emotions, not to be completely defined by them in the here and now. So you may be experiencing depressive thoughts. That doesn't mean that you're necessarily depressed. And there's a big distinction between these things. It may sound cliched, but I really believe that most cliches are things that have been proven over and over again. They've stood the test of time. And the phrase that I want to use is, you'll only appreciate the sun because you had to suffer the rain. And I really believe that. The next lesson is more of a financial one. And that is that you need to stop trying to time the market and instead dollar cost average for long-term wealth. The market is something that will continue to beat us up if we try and beat it. At different times throughout the last 4 years of the podcast, the market has varied hugely. At times it's been pretty buoyant like right now. Other times it's looked absolutely terrible. Things like the Ukraine war, the C19 lockdowns have all affected the market, and it can be a really emotional place. It's really easy to get swept away by negative sentiment at different times. But overall, you've heard me throughout all these different recordings, I'm pretty calm, largely because of the investment approach that I take, one that I've been convinced by a number of guests to continue to follow. And I've even debated with guests who maybe favour other approaches as well, and I push back on how they're set up, because my approach across all asset classes is pretty much the same, and that is the dollar or pound cost average. Pete Matthew, the podfather of UK finance, I had him on for episode 150, and he told me off for using the term dollar because obviously we're here in the UK. But he would endorse this investing strategy, as would the likes of Andrew Craig, Damien Talks Money, Steve Adcock, and many of the other brilliant financial guests that I've had on the show. Now, me name dropping these experts and these financially literate guests is not the be all and the end all, so let's actually get down into the approach that they advocate. So dollar cost averaging effectively refers to the practice of investing a consistent amount in the same asset, in the same investment over a period of time. This could be stocks, it could be shares, it could be trackers or funds, it could even be other assets like crypto or gold. Five-time guests on the show, Don Cameron and Dick Kelly of Crypto Glasgow, they explain this as well when it comes to crypto. It's not only restricted to traditional assets. So what they did is they bought coins that they liked from 2017 all the way through the bear market, accumulating these assets, whether the price had gone up, down, sideways, stayed the same. And I'm grateful for their stories of a time when crypto was surrounded by negative sentiment, they continued to buy. And you can do the same if it's in the stock market, if it's in the shares market, whatever. And by you accumulating during those low periods, you'll benefit during those high periods as well. So for example, when the market turned in late 2020, they saw a significant amount of success. But the overall strategy, I want to give a really clear fiscal example that you can picture in your head. And that is if you invest £300 a month. You can use this to invest in one stock or one fund every single month. And if that stock is trading at £10 one month, that means that you're buying 30 shares. If it later goes up to 12, that means that you're buying 25 shares that month. And even if the price fell another month to £8, for example, that means you accumulate 37 shares. You can see that your return on the £300 is varying every single month. But ultimately, what you're doing is you're steadily accumulating. You're going to benefit from getting more for less over the time, and sometimes you will pay a little bit more. Andrew Craig is one of the most popular financial guests that I've had on the podcast. He's the author of How to Own the World, and he came back on for episode 200 of the show, and he spoke really strongly about this. He doesn't mind the slight fluctuations that you see month to month or whatever your investing timeline is, and ultimately he embraces what you would call the smoothing effect of buying for many, many years. You'll get the highs where you paid a little bit more, but you won't miss the low prices. You won't miss any of the different price action with this approach. Andrew bluntly stated, and I wrote down this quote, "It's almost impossible to predict the bottom of the market. This is why dollar cost averaging can smooth out market timing. The overall result is a relentless accumulation of an asset class." Beyond smoothing, one of the main benefits I've seen from this approach is it removes a lot of the emotion. We're emotional creatures. I just spoke about Aria discussing our emotions in lesson one. If you have a direct debit of £300 a month that goes into your brokerage account the same day each month, it then buys the same two stocks or funds or whatever else you've chosen to automatically buy. There's no umming and ahhing or whether you're going to jump in this month. There's no umming and ahhing of which stock you're going to change to. Ultimately, emotional investors make bad decisions. They buy high, they sell low. The market typically will win. You're going to make worse decisions under stress, or you're going to get swept up in the news narrative at the time, whether that's positive or negative. I want you to veer away from the funds that enable you to try and chase the next high, chase the next thing, and instead take your time and pick the things that matter to you at that moment in time and just consistently average in. The next lesson is the secret to being more productive. That's something that everyone wants to do. Everyone that listens to a podcast at this one, you want to tick off more tasks on the to-do list. You want to achieve milestones. You want to feel accomplished. But it's not really that easy, or at least it's not that simple. There's lots of things that are stopping you. And for years, I obsessed over a fraction of the important things that really mattered. I was determined to perfect things like my working environment. I was determined to build the ultimate productive space. I was determined to have no distractions whatsoever, or possibly limit those that could get access to me. And while your environment is important and it will dictate performance to a large extent, it does neglect some of the vital parts that I've learned about through some of my guests. In particular, I learned from Nir Eyal, who's the author of Indistractable. And when he came on the show, he was able to crystallize things a lot more for me. And I want to share with you four actions that I've taken to be more productive, largely inspired by Nir, but also by me putting them into practice. Before I share those four, I just want to quickly emphasize how hard this is as well. It's so easy to get caught up in the pings and the dings and the notifications of daily life. I genuinely feel inundated at times. Most of you know I still work in my corporate job and my emails are going off at all hours of the night, whether that's from clients or prospects or internal stuff. And then of course I'm running the podcast and all the different social media channels that I use to promote it as well. There's always something that I can look at or reply to instead of doing what I said I was going to do. And I genuinely feel busier than ever before at times, and the distractions are everywhere. Acknowledging that these distractions and disruptions are going to come up is really important. And that is ultimately how you're going to become indistractable or more productive, because that's what we're truly aiming for, to be someone who cannot be distracted, who cannot be deviated from the course, and to be productive and indistractable is one and the same. So that brings me to my four. And the first of those is to change your identity and make a pact. That is not me looking to make some sort of gender identity political point. Instead, I want you to shape your identity around productivity. I want you to decide that you're no longer a person who gets distracted. Your values don't align with being distracted, and it's just not you. Changing your identity works in so many areas of life. It's actually one of the most common ways that people stop smoking. They just stop identifying as a smoker. They don't say, no, I'm not having a cigarette tonight because I'm trying to give up smoking. They say, no, I'm not having a cigarette because I'm not a smoker. Instead, what you're going to do is you're going to take on the identity of somebody who's indistractable. You can swap indistractable for productive. You can swap it to focused, whatever term you want to use. That is what matters to you. And you're going to embrace the habits of that new identity as someone who is productive. So for example, when you feel the urge to check your phone, you can ask yourself this question: what would someone who is productive do in this situation? Would they check their phone? Would they take a break from this task to go on WhatsApp? And this links really heavily to doing the things that align with your purpose and who you see yourself as a person. Because when you don't know what your identity is and you don't know what your purpose is, it's a lot easier to falter, and having clarity on why you do the things you do will lead to much better outcomes. I also like to zoom out and think about how the daily small tasks that I do contribute to the bigger overall goal. So having sight of that bigger overall goal and having sight of the kind of person who might go on to achieve that overall goal is really, really important. The second one I've got when it comes to productivity is recognizing your triggers. Now, initially, I used to always think about external triggers. So that'd be things like notifications or emails. Now, almost all of those should be off. Don't argue with me about that, but you should have most of your notifications off apart from phone calls from important people. But Nir went way beyond that, and he explained to me about internal triggers. And the quote that he shared was, human behavior is prompted by a desire to escape discomfort. This means that time management is pain management. I'll say that again. Time management is pain management. I'm not saying that you're in pain throughout the day when you're deciding to check your phone, but what I am telling you is that you are doing things to escape a level of pain. So become aware of how you're feeling when you find yourself getting the most distracted. The more self-aware you are, the easier it's going to be to manage that distraction. That feeling that makes you want to stop the task. I really had to think hard about this, and it was a little bit unpleasant at times, because when I felt uncertainty about the immediate next step, that was when I was the most likely to move away. So if I was writing a hard email to a client, I wasn't sure what to say next, I would maybe open up LinkedIn, or I would reply to an easier internal email. This is escaping the pain of uncertainty. I'm not, again, when you're looking to move away from a task, it's not because you're stupid or naive or you're in excruciating pain. It's just that little niggle of discomfort, and that's when you move away from this. So when I now know this, when I'm writing a hard email and I know that I'll try and escape to LinkedIn, I recognize this and I can do what I would call surfing that urge. I sit within the feeling, I ride it out, and I keep working. It's actually happened throughout prepping for this particular podcast. When I was writing down all these lessons, collating them together so that I could deliver this episode, when it got hard or when I wasn't quite sure what lesson to cover next or how to explain something, when I felt that discomfort about what to type next, I would go and check Instagram DMs. I would justify that someone might need a reply with me helping them or supporting them, or maybe I need to reply to this email to book in this next podcast guest. But that's just me running away from the challenge. Instead, I have to accept there's a little bit of discomfort present, and unless I acknowledge it, I'm going to keep trying to escape that pain as quickly as I can. So take some time to think about how you're feeling when you seek distraction, when you reach for your phone, when you jump out of the task that you're meant to be doing. Learn to sit with it, surf the distraction, surf the feeling, and don't take the easy route out. Number three, use a time-boxed calendar. I have been a proponent of a to-do list for years and years and years, but ultimately it's not enough to just know what you need to do. You need to know when and how long it's going to take. A time box calendar solves that, and it means that you can plan in advance how things are going to work out. And this can also help to curb some of those external triggers that we're going to talk about too. For me, I actually plan in time in my diary for relaxing and switching off. I commit to when I'm going to catch up on WhatsApp. I commit to when I'm going to plan to watch YouTube or Netflix. And the main difference is that that's in the diary. When I do it, I'm intending to do it, and I actually get more from it. Now, some people might think that sounds a bit robotic, but when I've got as much in my schedule as I do, actually planning and using the calendar to box out when things are going to happen is a huge, huge help for me. When these are activities that I want to do, so for example, I mentioned on some previous podcast that I'm aiming to play more golf, I schedule it in my calendar. My gym sessions, they're booked in my calendar. I know it's coming up, and it's something that I'm looking forward to. It also encourages me to use the other time available to me to do the task that I need to do, because I've got this carrot in front of me of I'm playing nine holes on Thursday evening at 6 o'clock. Best believe between 4 and 5, when I know I've got this other task to do, I can be more present and focus on it. And then when I get to golf, I'm also not thinking about that lingering task that I put off and I didn't manage to do. And it's even the same on a smaller scale with things like social media checking. I'm really avoiding those TikTok or Instagram reel or Twitter binges, because when I'm meant to be preparing for a work presentation or writing content for my email list, I've got those things planned in. So I know at 12 o'clock, I'm going to be dialed into that. So I'm scheduling things that I enjoy, and I'm taking the time to do that. Now, number four is a slightly more practical tool for your phone. And this is something that a lot of people jump to first before thinking about the things that I've just covered. And I know I've said that internal triggers are the most important thing, but let's be honest, my phone's my biggest distraction. It's probably yours too. So here's three practical ways for you to manage this. Number one, and this is something that I can't believe more of us are not doing, but sleep with your phone outside your bedroom. By giving yourself 30 minutes before bed and the same when waking up without it, you'll actually be surprised at how quickly you remove that immediate gratification from the phone and you stop checking it first thing, and you'll actually stop checking it throughout the day as much as well. My brain does not crave my phone nearly as much if I don't start using it early on. The bigger gap I can have between waking and then checking my phone, the more resilient I am to wanting to look at it during the day. I also remove my phone from my working environment at times. So if I'm working in the living room, my phone will be in my bedroom between 9 and 12. And that's what I call my kind of deep work block. And I'm really, really dialed in on that. I actually did it to prepare for this podcast. So when I was writing out these notes in my living room, best believe my phone was out of sight. It was out of mind, or at least it was out of easy reach. Now, the second one is around apps. And the ones that have been the most popular have been self-control and more recently one called Opal. And you can actually use it to block apps like Instagram or TikTok at set times where it will lock you out of that. Now, that's an extreme measure, but you simply cannot use or open the app. And this can be applied by blocking news feeds or particular websites on your laptop as well. One of the more popular ones for laptop is called Cold Turkey. And I know this works really, really well. And many of my friends, particularly guys that are in the copywriting space, like Chris Burns and Mike Samuel, both of who have been on the podcast, swear by these apps to get into deep focus and get deep written work. Now, the last one is a bit of an unusual one, and it's more of a behavioral one when it comes to using your phone. So say, for example, I agree, I'm not going to use my personal phone between 9 o'clock and midday. When I do use it at 12 o'clock and I go and check it and I'm doing my Instagram and I'm doing my WhatsApps, I stand up when I'm using it. Now, this is another self-policed behavior. So only you can be accountable to you. But at the time that you agree to check your WhatsApp and do your replies, if you stand up, you're less likely to get comfortable and less likely to sit back and just start scrolling and enter that kind of attention black hole. All of this combined will massively increase your productivity. And I think the episode I've done with Nia Rial is a real gateway for how I've been able to juggle so many of the things that I've done and build the podcast to where it is. The next lesson is one that is back to the finance world, and that's from Steve Adcock, who became financially free at the age of just 35 and retired. And the quote that he said to me was 99% of investors should be 100% index fund investors. Stock picking is not a game that a lot of us are ready to play. Automation of our dollar cost averaging is a vital component, but with the removal of emotion about which stock or which fund, you also take administration out of it as well. Very few people that I know personally have the time to be checking the apps regularly or playing around with the stocks or reviewing the price or reviewing the actual use case of a company. And numerous guests have really hammered home on that point. Nick Magilli, he wrote a book called Just Keep Buying, huge American guest, and he bemoaned what he called the stock bros who sat there checking what stock to lump into this week, all the while actually not having the amount invested in it that's really going to make a difference. So he laughed that, for example, the yield you get on what is a relatively small return, so say you're investing £500 a month, that's great, but 20% on that is £100 a month. That's not exactly life-changing. So you spending time finding a stock that might do 20% versus 10% or 15% is not that important in the grand scheme of things. And it's probably a poor hourly rate for the amount of time that you're taking to research, but also when you consider the stress cost of that as well. Andrew Craig was somebody else as well. He really shook his head and he was saying that the time that we spend fretting over what to buy, when to sell, and what it could get to, if we spent that on a side hustle, generating more income, maybe working some extra shifts, or whisper it, even just creating a bit more mastery in our day job to increase our earning power, that's ultimately what's going to increase the main way that we can increase our investing power, because money into the market matters far more than we often talk about. For balance on this subject, I have interviewed guys who hold up trading and who pick stocks or who pick commodities that they want to trade. And one of the most early guests I had on around this was VP. He is actually an anonymous guy online who has a channel on YouTube called No Nonsense Forex. That was episode 38. And it was actually my most ever played episode on YouTube, which I find quite funny. But VP argued the case for trading foreign currencies, so foreign exchange, but he also acknowledged 90% of traders lose when trading this asset. So very few people that I know have traded Forex with any success. However, I do know people who have been successful with stock trading. Equally, that's still a really small number because trading, for example, stock options is a little bit more understandable if you've been in the stock market before, but it's still a hugely challenging space and it's a process that I'm not particularly well versed in. With that in mind, of course, asked an expert onto the podcast to talk about it, a gentleman called Simon Ree back on episode 143, and he'd actually built a 30-year career trading stock options, and now he teaches others through his academy. So I learned a lot about the approach and how it would work, but I made an assessment. I'm still not going to assign that level of time to my investments in my portfolio, and I also don't have the level of risk appetite and tolerance needed, because it's actually a level of risk that I don't see myself taking. The riskiest asset that I have exposure to is some of my crypto assets, and that's just about enough for me. So to bring that lesson to life, I've picked individual stocks 3 times during 2020. I picked ones that had dipped during the pandemic, and all 3 of those at the time of recording 2024 are still in the red. So I've very much learned my lesson, whereas all the index funds that I'm in are up, they're positive, and I don't think about them nearly as much. Okay, on to the next lesson, and it's what I call the 4-3-2 method to find fulfillment in your career or business. One of the most frequently asked questions on all my solo podcasts is, why do you still work in your corporate job? How are you still enjoying it? And it's clear that I love the personal brand side of what I'm doing and the social media side and the podcast side, but it's not been enough to pull me away really quickly from the corporate world. Because, and I use this example all the time, the whole Jordan Peterson rat experiment, you need to be pulling away from something as well as running towards something. And I've not been in a rush to escape the corporate world because I've always done jobs typically that I enjoy or ones that stimulate me. And it's that, I think that's surprisingly rare. Very few of us actively enjoy what we do between 9 and 5pm. And that's wrong. We shouldn't enjoy every single second of it. Of course not. That would be absurd. We talked about the range of human emotions that we should experience. But it is possible to find fulfillment in what you're doing, whether that's for yourself or whether that's within an organization. So based on some great conversations, I'm going to share a framework that I learned, and I've built out a little bit of this myself as well. And this was heavily influenced by two episodes in particular, one with Dr. Yusuf Smith and one with Darren Lee. And these are both guys I really respect in this space. So Yusuf made huge career decisions, including he left an investment banking role after a four-year degree at university to return to university to study medicine. Alongside that, he built Propane as an online coaching business. And after qualifying and working as a junior doctor, he then went on to leave and work full-time within Propane as well. So he's a man that really understands these things. Darren, he's worked so hard to establish himself and what he really wants to do. And while he was building his side passion with Kickoff Sessions podcast, you'll have heard me on there potentially, and you've definitely heard Darren on this show, he pursued a career in the fast-paced world of fintech, specifically with Revolut. So he got a really good understanding as a product owner of software and some of the valuable skills that come with building out. And that actually enabled him over the longer term to launch a state-of-the-art media company, which is called Voix, and that manages and launches podcasts. So the framework that these guys helped me build out was the 4-3-2. And it's the 4-3-2, it might sound like a football team, but that's or a formation, but you're missing a player, so it's not. In terms of the first four, it's the four currencies. So look at it this way. Currency one is money. We can all relate to that. Currency two is how much freedom of time we have. Currency three is how much freedom of location we have. And currency four is how much satisfaction or fulfillment we have. When you take the time to understand what you currently do and what you might want to do, you need to break down of each of those four, which of those are achieved. So for example, you might quite possibly be winning when it comes to the money currency. You might be earning lots of money, but you don't like what you do. Equally, you might have your own business and it's not doing as much money as you want, but you've turned out you've got freedom of location because you work from your laptop. There's a delta there. We need to find out which one we're optimizing for and which one we care about the most. Equally, I know that in a sales role, what I've optimized for is one is the money. I don't have freedom of location. I don't have freedom of time, but I actually have quite a lot of satisfaction when I'm closing deals and when I'm winning deals. So if I look at my career, that's the case. Whereas if I was doing the podcast, I would probably have 3, freedom of location, 4, satisfaction, and one day, who knows, maybe I can get that money part. So there's a lot to think about there. The third part of this is what I got from Darren, and that is 3 questions to ask yourself. Number one, what do you value most? Number two, what is the ratio you want across those 4 currencies? And number three, what time frame matters to you? Can you sacrifice one currency over the other? Take this really seriously and actually write down those answers with a pen and paper or a document in your laptop and really, really get clear on those. Something that I learned from the Ariel, as I said, was we will be more likely to procrastinate or try to escape or delay if we don't know what the next logical step is. So if I'm not sure what to write next in the email or I'm not sure what next to write next in my notes, I'm going to try and go and check Instagram. I'm trying to try and escape. So the two that I've added to this framework are action-based. And many of you have seen that hashtag on my Instagram post over the year, hashtag take action. But don't do this deep searching exercise without knowing what comes next. So number one for me is an action. Once you've got clear on the four currencies, once you've got clear on what matters to you, connect and speak to 2 people that are doing a job or running a similar business to the one that you want. Get time with them, understand what it's like for them, get their advice, move forward from there. Number two, and this will likely come from that conversation, identify the skills that are the most valued and needed for your future. And then it's really clear, you need to go from there. You need to try and acquire those skills. You need to try and build them up. You need to really double down on these. Don't waste your time on other areas. Focus specifically on these. I think if you look at those 4-3-2, you can't really fail to get clear. on what you want to do next. Ultimately, it's not going to happen overnight, but it is going to give you something to shoot towards. And I really have used this framework multiple times over the last 12 months to assess where I'm at in my current career, where I'm at in terms of my desires for the future. And it's really helped me identify what skills that I'm going to work on for what's coming next and what skills that I've got existing that serve me really, really well. And it's also allowed me to ask my employer for what I want from a learning development perspective and also what mentorships and coaching I've invested from away from work. Next lesson, the importance of how and why you need to get the best possible sleep. Until 2018, the personal development community, in particular a couple of creators, seemed to really laugh in the face of sleep. And the content creators around that time that I consumed, they really glamorized the hustle, the work harder and work smarter approach, which for me just doesn't compute. That whole grind set culture, and don't get me wrong, I work really hard, I'm really focused, I really take up a lot of my time, but sleep is something that I prioritize. Whereas you had the likes of maybe Gary Vaynerchuk back in the day talking about, 16 hours of work, 1 hour exercise, 5 hours of sleep. This has since been rubbished. And I think a big turning point was Matthew Walker's appearance on the Joe Rogan podcast. And while there's some debate around elements of the science and the data that Matthew shared, the core of what he shared about focusing on sleep and making the most of it and how important it is for our performance is very, very important. So when I was starting the podcast, I really made sure I was going to get a credible guest to talk about all things sleep. In fact, I actually managed to get two. And one of them was from one of the best universities in the world. And that was Dr. Nora Simpson, who was at the University of Stanford, I believe. And then the other expert that I got was somebody who had 30 years of experience as a psychologist and a sleep and energy expert. And that was Dr. Navira Ramakan. So back on episode 29, Nora said to me a number of things that really leveled up my knowledge when it came to sleep. She had a 2018 paper that I actually read before the podcast. So that was my commitment. I read an academic paper before speaking to her. And she was talking about the necessary focus to maximize your performance and how that can be applied to athletes, but also what I would call like an office athlete or an everyday athlete. And the ones that really stood out were around how much sleep loss and the quality of your sleep impacts that. So she was talking about how it takes a toll on your emotions. Most people that have a lack of quality sleep or a lack of total sleep, it drastically lowers their mood, it decreases physical performance and output, it reduces mental focus, and essentially it makes progress in any area much, much harder. It's like handicapping yourself in terms of your ability. In contrast, they found that quality sleep was linked with a number of positive personality traits in terms of optimism, self-esteem, confidence, as well as better concentration and even willpower. The willpower aspect was something that really stood out to me, because if I think about when I'm the most tired, it's when I'm the most likely to want to cheat on my diet or check my phone or seek comfort. And that's something that everyone should consider. When you're sleeping well, there's so many benefits. Beyond the mental benefits, there was also a lot of notable positive benefits when it came to training. So better recovery from training, lower injury risk, improved ability to generate strength more frequently across your week, which is a study that Nora brought to life. And ultimately, high quality sleep also reduces your susceptibility to illness. Again, win-win. Now, most of the research, including Nora's, showed that 7 to 9 hours of sleep per night was what was required, and that would help you stave off these ill effects. I did actually push back and discuss if there's any outliers to that and how that is the case. And there are some people with genetics that enable them to function well on 6 hours or less, but the chances of you being one of them is literally 1 in 100, 1%. So having outlined the downsides of sleep and the deprivation and the benefits of being optimal, Nora shared some of the best ways to improve your sleep hygiene and the routines to get you into that. And that includes things like your pre-bed routine, your environment, and also research-proven strategies that you can involve. So I wrote down 5 in total that have really stuck with me. And the first of those is get into your circadian rhythm. This was a relatively new term to me when I started the podcast, but ultimately it's the rhythm that your body operates at. So getting to your bed earlier and having consistent wake time with the aim of hitting 8 hours is actually enabling you to get into a flow of sleep. For me, on a personal basis, I'm up between 6 or 6.30 most days, meaning that I need to really be in bed trying to sleep at between 9.30 and 10 p.m. And that sounds really early, but it means I just maybe cut back on the amount of Netflix that I watch, or I'm slightly more routined, or I'm slightly more focused on nailing that. And because my body has the consistency of going to bed at those times and waking up into those times, it falls into a pattern. And it starts to send the right signals to your brain at the right time. If it's used to sleeping at 10 p.m., it starts the process for you. It starts to release melatonin naturally, and it readies you for slumber. While in the morning, it starts to get ready to fire. It starts producing cortisol, and that starts firing around your body, preparing you to get out of bed and go. And if I'm doing that as a minimum 6 nights a week, I actually feel so much better rested. And if I've not got like a later social engagement on the weekends, I'll try and adhere to this as much as I can, even 7 days if possible. So don't knock an early bedtime and don't knock your routine until you've tried it. The second one is the hour before bed matters. And that's all about protecting that hour before bed. Blue light, which is associated with our mobile phones and our devices, is a big barrier to quality deep sleep. When you combine that with the actual stimulus of what you're consuming on your phone, so fast-paced reels or Instagram videos, or maybe you're swiping Tinder and pestering the opposite sex, your sleep is going to be disrupted. Your brain is still not evolved to handle this, and ultimately, evolution has taught us that this intense stimulus from our technology is something we're not ready for yet. You'll actually find sometimes when you're dreaming, you're actually still mentally digesting some of what you've seen on your phone. So somebody you've been messaging on Instagram or watching their stories, they might end up in your dream. So the aftermath and the alternative that you need to seek out is get the phone away, get a book out, try and protect yourself from that blue light. For me, it's putting my phone either outside the bedroom and using an alarm, or putting my phone on the other side of my bedroom on charge. And that means, it also means, there's a benefit. I need to get up and touch my phone and turn my alarm off when I'm up in the morning. But I'm not somebody that suffered from anxiety, but I can tell you right now that I'm my most anxious when I can't get to sleep at night or when I wake up during the night. And I really think that the ways that I've been able to tackle that have been, one, removing my phone stimulus right before I go to bed. Two, brain dumping my thoughts with a pen and paper and setting out my to-do list and my time box for the next day. And lastly, I've been formally gratitude journaling during that time as well. So listing the things that went well, what I can improve on, why I'm grateful. And I use that hour before bed to do some of these habits, and it's noticeably helped the quality of my sleep. Number three is a bit more of a practical one, and that's actually getting rid of that blue light and the daylight as well. And that's to sleep in a cave. So Nora explained the ideal situation is to sleep in a cave. Now, that's not me swapping my bedroom for somewhere that's unpleasant, but ultimately caves are cool, they're dark, and they're quiet. So for you, you want to aim for ensuring coolness. So that might not be a huge problem for many of you that are listening in the UK, but you can make sure that you've maybe got your window open. I probably say I would have my window open for 10 months out of the 12, and it's only like really the deepest, darkest winter where it's too cold. But outside of that, I just want to have light pajamas on, a light duvet, and I want to remain nice and cool. For darkness, invest in decent blinds or curtains that are going to keep your room dark during the right hours. And I've paid well over the odds for blinds in the flat, but I think they've paid for themselves in terms of the dividends. But another safeguard that I've got, and a lot of people will have a go at me for this, is actually an eye mask. And I mean, I've upgraded to a silk one, and I cannot tell you how good that's been for my sleep. And I also make sure I take it with me when I stay in hotels as well. In terms of for quietness of the cave, I'm lucky that my flat is quite quiet, and when my window's open, you'll maybe hear the birds in the morning or something like that, but that's not the end of the world. Something that I have used when I've gone to hotels, and I'm going to use it when I'm back in Dubai next week, is I use these things called Sleepy Panda, and they're like moldable ear guards. And they were a little bit uncomfortable at first, but if you're really used to wearing AirPods or earphones, then you'll manage quite quickly to use those as well to improve the level of quietness you get. And they're still not enough for you to sleep through your alarm, which is the most important thing. Number four is substances. Now, I'm not going to get too wild here because people assume substances automatically links to narcotics or drugs, but the first substance I want to talk about is caffeine. In short, caffeine has a half-life of around 6 hours. This means that if I drink 250 megs of caffeine at 6 p.m., I'm still going to have about 125 meg in my system at around midnight. So caffeine, it masks tiredness, it encounters with our adrenal system, and ultimately, you might fall asleep, but you won't get into a deeper sleep that you're aiming for. So with this in mind, you need to think about moving that caffeine cutoff earlier in the day. So take it easy on the pre-workout, take it easy on the coffee, particularly if you're going to be training later in the day, you want to be dialing that back earlier on, and hopefully having it early enough in the day to feel the effects of your training, but not to disrupt your sleep. My habit used to be chinning 150 meg white monster at 5 p.m. before I would go and train after the office. And this meant at around 10 p.m, I've still got 75 meg of caffeine in my system. Now that's not insane amount, but it's enough to disrupt the quality of sleep. So I've started to move this earlier and earlier. It's probably around 2 o'clock now. And if I train at lunchtime, it's at midday. So there's a lot to be said for moving that forward, because I really noticed the quality of my sleep being better. The next substance I want to talk about is alcohol. And many will cite alcohol as something that helps them fall asleep or helps them unwind. This doesn't show up in any of the literature whatsoever, because while it may help you fall asleep, studies have showed that it's actually more of a sedation than sleep. So you're knocked out into a light sleep rather than a deep sleep. And in short, there is no benefit for alcohol when it comes to sleep. Instead, it can actually increase restlessness and wakefulness throughout the night. The final substance that I want to talk about, and this is just any form of liquid, water, Diet Coke, juice, whatever you're having, it's actually helpful for you to taper off your liquid intake around 90 minutes to 2 hours before bed. I joke on Instagram that I've got a tiny bladder, and it really is the case. Even when I'm sitting down this podcast, you know, I might need to take a break to go for the bathroom. But ultimately, that was really disrupting my night's sleep. So the earlier that I cut off my drinking before I go to sleep, the better. For me, it's probably about between 7 and 7:30 at night that I'm cutting off, because if I want to be sleeping by 9:30, 10 o'clock, that's really, really helped me as well. I've also noticed that caffeine is a diuretic and it makes you piss. So if you can cut your caffeine off earlier, it will also help you sleep through the night without needing a pee. Next up, and the final thing when it comes to sleep, is supplements and hacks. Both the sleep experts that I interviewed on the show were pretty bearish on supplements overall. If you really feel that the supplements that you take for your sleep work for you, that's great. But there's not a huge amount of data to support lots of them. The most popular ones when I spoke to those guys back in 2020, 2021 were CBD and ZMA. And it can help to generate a deeper sleep in some individuals, but it's not guaranteed. Instead, a real hack that Nora shared, and Dr. Narina actually endorsed as well, was if you're struggling to feel drowsy before bed, have a warm shower. In the same way a cold shower in the morning wakes you up and gets your hormones firing, a warm shower will elevate your body temperature. And if you time this about 30 minutes before you go to your bed, it forces your body to regulate. And as you're starting to cool down, you will actually feel like you are more drowsy, more tired, and more sleepy. So as your hormones are being released to your body, you're actually going to prompt drowsiness. And that's a little bit of a hack. That won't be a problem for everyone in Scotland, but it definitely helps me. Next up, and this is a little bit of a shorter lesson because it's one that I think it speaks for itself and it's quite exciting, and it's from David Robson, The Expectation Effect and the Power of Your Mind. David Robson's book is called The Expectation Effect, and he's going to be back on for his new book, which is The Law of Connections, later this summer. But ultimately, The Expectation Effect explains how our thoughts can impact how our bodies operate. He talked about two different effects, the nocebo effect, which is basically the opposite of the placebo effect, and how that can hinder results before we've even started. When we think about things, it actually impacts our health, our athletic performance, our sleep, our mental well-being, our life expectancy, and even how we interact with food we consume, medicine we take, and the supplements we have as well. Importantly, David stresses that it was not a case of just switching to blue sky thinking or blind optimism or manifesting about all these great things that are going to happen when you're just lying in your bed, but it's actually a more profound and empowering use of your mind and your psychology to self-distance from external factors and not fear the worst at all times, and instead focus on the locus of control that you have to enable you to concede. Some of the examples he gave were pretty mind-blowing, to be honest, in some of the studies that he shared, because one of the ones was around gluten intolerance. And he actually found an experiment that people experienced the same symptoms and after effects of somebody who's actually celiac if they were told that they had a gluten intolerance and they consumed something with gluten, even if for the food they were given didn't have any gluten in it. So that is wild for me. And they actually had people who thought they had gluten in a meal who were celiac, and their body responded as if they started breaking out in hives, they started having inflammation. The experiment actually was what caused this effect rather than any form of gluten. So it's funny what the mind can do if it believes something to be the case. And the same was actually trialed for people when it came to their athletic performance as well. And everyone in the study had some sort of different genetic capabilities when it came to their VO2 max. But guess what? The performance of people who were told that they had lesser genetics and were told that they would perform more badly than their peers came into fruition, even if they were somebody that actually had favorable VO2 max genetics, while those who had the favorable genetics but were told that they didn't performed worse. So really, really, really important that you understand the power of your expectations before going into something. And again, a lot of guests have spoken positively about manifestation, but this is on a deeper level of how you can shape your outcomes. This next lesson is one that was at the very, very start of the podcast, and that was episode 1 with Chris Williamson, and that was sobriety is not just for addicts. I'm going to admit, I had a bias before I started the podcast. I was already a pretty big advocate of elective sobriety, and choosing to opt out of alcohol through choice for sustained periods and like little sprints or periods when I was really focused on other things. But this has probably grown stronger during my time of recording, and that bias might have led to some of the guests that I've chosen to interview in the podcast and some of the individuals that I've spoken to, but I don't regret that one bit, because some of the most powerful feedback that I receive over DM is people who have listened to episodes where I've encouraged, or the guests encouraged, people to reevaluate their relationship with alcohol. And Cambro Conversation started with a real bang. Chris Williamson, host of the Modern Wisdom podcast, somebody that I see as a real leader when it comes to personal development in the UK and the world. And across the range of subjects that I covered with Chris in that first episode was alcohol and his own sobriety. This was recorded back in March 2020, and he was actually in the middle of a 1,000-day sober streak. And this had started as a planned six-month break. But as you'll know, if you're somebody listening to this that's ever tried sobriety, it actually tends to compound and it becomes harder to want to start again. And I'd flirted at that point with sober stints, and I've maybe done 3 months here, 2 months there. I was already pretty unenthused by alcohol, and I had my own opinions, but I really needed to delve deeper into the topic. And Chris laid out a few areas in the episode that he personally benefited from, and it kind of painted that light for me. He'd built 3 businesses, he'd bought 5 houses that he rents out to students and generated a passive income, he'd travelled to 15 different countries, and he'd built Modern Wisdom, which at the time in March 2020 was already successful, and now is this unbelievable behemoth. But for this particular lesson around sobriety, and from who I've spoken to over the years, I've collated benefits to go way beyond that, including some of my own and some of the other guests that I've spoken to as well. And for me, elective sobriety opens up a number of things: greater attention and focus, true confidence in yourself, adherence to your habits, better sleep, improved mental health, increased available time to you, additional money, and excess calories to use as you wish. For the purposes today, I'm going to pick just a few of these to delve a little bit deeper into. And one of the ones that stands out is true confidence, because when you don't have that comfort blank or that Dutch courage in social situations or even in a dating environment, your inhibitions are slightly higher before you get started. And when you've had alcohol, you can maybe blunder over and approach somebody cold, or you can have a conversation with a stranger more easily. And people get a little bit more brazen, a little bit louder. And I can definitely tell you, alcohol has had a place in my life for me making fun friendships or for me being more confident to go and talk to girls. But I can tell you now, having used sobriety over the last 4 years and at different times dialed up and dialed down, I'm much more confident now in my true self, because I've been in so many different situations where I've not had that Dutch courage. I've had to back myself without any of the frills, without that slight high and that slight elevation. And I've been to so many nights out, I've been to so many networking events, and I've really thrived. I've enjoyed great conversations, and I've actually felt sharper and more able to converse articulately. My memory's been better of what I've talked about. And you'll also notice, and this is a great filter, you'll be more selective on the people that you spend time with at these events, or even the events, you might even not go to particular events because you're not drinking at them, because your confidence will be higher to not just go with the flow and not just turn up and sit tight and listen to the same drivel that you've had, or be habituated to go to the same bar you've always gone to. And it is a little bit of a shock, and Chris spoke about this. A lot of the people that you spend your time with might just be drinking buddies and not friends, and you'll be able to strike out from away from that if you choose sobriety for a decent period of time and build better and deeper friendships. You'll also want to do better and build more of those challenging habits that you've always sought after and aimed at. So listen to this, be honest, put your hand up if you eat more junk food on a hangover. And if your hand's down right now, I can guarantee you're a liar, or maybe you're driving a car and you don't want to endanger your life. But it's not just healthy eating that becomes harder when you're hungover or feeling the after effects of a heavy night out. Sticking to the other positive habits that you want to set out is harder too, whether that's an exercise habit, whether that's a meditation habit, whether that's a mindfulness habit, whether it's journaling, whether that's just going out earlier in the morning for your walk or your training. It's not just confined to that one hangover day, because generally you'll find yourself more tired and less able in the days afterwards as well. Everyone knows that feeling. You're on a roll, you've got these new habits, you're sticking to them. The best intentions that you had are all being achieved. One big night out and it's disrupted. One of the really popular early guests that I had about sobriety was Andy Ramage. And back in August 2020, he was laughing that before he quit drinking, he always threatened, I'm going to lose this stubborn belly fat that I've got. I'm going to start meditating. I'm going to switch my diet to, I think he was maybe turning vegan. But it was impossible until he stopped drinking. And importantly, I want to raise that I'm not somebody that stopped drinking forever. Neither is Chris, who brought this lesson to me. But when you have these periods of sobriety, use those stints to build up those new habits more strongly, because you'll have more available bandwidth to do it. And that's also important. You also have a lot more time. I can wholeheartedly say I wouldn't be sat down writing those lessons last night before I came to this podcast studio, speaking to you today about 250 podcasts without the sustained breaks that I had. 250 podcasts in the time frame that I've had, alongside my corporate job, alongside my social life, alongside training and staying in shape, would just not have happened. I very rarely have a wasted hungover day, and it's an absolute game changer for realizing how much time you have available to you if you don't have that broken period of sleep and energy in those days afterwards. So sobriety for me is a huge, huge tool. And I've said this quote a number of times, both myself and one of my guests used it, a guy called Ed Lattimore. He said, alcohol is the only drug where if you don't do it, people assume it's you that has a problem. You don't need to have an alcohol problem to benefit from going sober. In fact, you can actually benefit from the fact that it's a proactive choice rather than something that's forced on you by addiction or a health necessity. Equally, if you're someone listening to this that feels that they may have an addiction, seek out that help and try and get involved in that self-development community, which can really wake you up and support you in what you're moving forward with. One of the final quotes that Chris said that I want to share with you is, once you reprogram through, let's say, a 90-day or a three-month break from alcohol, there's no sense of social pressure to drink. There's no coping mechanism and there's no habituated routines, because everyone knows that if they get into a routine of going out every Friday, Saturday, it's really, really hard to break that. So having a sustained break rewires your mind and you get a choice dictated by what you gain from drinking during that period and not just doing the same thing that you've always done. Next lesson. Everyone of us listening to this is playing a status game. And if you're not aware that you're playing a status game, you may not understand why you do what you do or why you don't do what you wish you would do. This is a lesson from best-selling author Will Storr. And like he said when we spoke earlier in the year, he said to me that the status game that we're playing is something that many people try to pretend that we're not playing. So status seeking is something that's inbuilt to our human nature. And some of the examples he gave in his book were quite dark examples. People like Elliot Rodger, the incel killer, the cult leaders that he followed, the Nazis and the Germans that supported them during World War II and before that. And even the first social media platform, The Well, had people that were all playing different types of status games. And we played them across all different areas, because ultimately, as evolutionary beings, we're seeking competition and seeking hierarchy to understand where we are. And it's not a frivolous activity. Any creature in the natural world is seeking higher status because it brings abundance of access to better food, more land, more romantic relationships, and the ability to continue on our lineage as well. But recognizing that status is a double-edged sword is really important as well, because when you have people that are seeking status, that can lead to you striving for the best and the worst in life. So scientists and inventors that are striving to make a name for themselves in the industry or in their field, that will have a positive effect because it's driving human progress. But they might fuck over or push people out of the way or do unethical experiments in order to get there. Equally, somebody who wants to get ahead of the competition, as shown by some of the examples that Will gave around the Nazis or some of the cult leaders that he followed, they might commit murder or war or genocide. So the status game typically centers around either being successful when it comes to success and prestige or virtue. And we spent some time in the episode talking about how many people online now try to signal virtue
either through maybe posting it at a particular world events or a cause they believe in or their opinions, or they might do fundraising and support charities. Now, one of these is probably more impactful than the other when it comes to the literal sense of the impact, but both these activities are attempts, whether we acknowledge it or not, to gain status for our virtue and our goodness. Equally, I know that I've sought to get better at sales because I want the status of being seen as a good sales director, good at my job, talented in my job, hardworking. And that fuels me. So once we understand that we're status-seeking individuals, it's much easier to accept and understand our behavior. It's much easier to understand the choices that we make. It's much easier to view what we do and what others are doing. And it's not necessarily a negative thing. It's just something you need to be aware of. And one of the antidotes that Will puts forward, because this can be like quite a challenging thing to hear, is have several status games that you're playing. In other words, don't define yourself by one game that you play. So don't just be the fitness guy. Don't just be the family guy. Don't just be the career guy. Don't just be the business guy. Because he said, people who appear to be brainwashed have invested too much of their identity in a single game. If that game fails or they become expelled or cast off, their identity, their very self, can disintegrate. No such risk can befall the player with a diversity of identities who plays diverse games. So Will gave the example that he is, of course, an author and he strives for best-selling books and to have a positive impact on his readers, but he also works in the charity sector to, quote-unquote, signal his virtue and support people that he wants to care about. And he has a sporting background as well. So he's playing diverse games, so he's not defined by just one. Next up, Dr. Julie Gurner. And I honestly could have shared 10, 15 lessons from this podcast alone. It's one of my favorite episodes that I've done. And this lesson that I've chose to share today is called Fight Up Front. Dr. Gurner gave the example of being grabbed and kidnapped and attempted to be put in the back of a van. And she explained that that situation, when you're in that van and wherever you get taken to next, is only going to get worse from the moment that you end up in the van. So it's better to have the fight at the point and rather than let things proceed, because in any way, it's only going to get worse. Yes, it's hugely risky. Yes, it's frightening to have that fight before you get in the van, but things are not going to get better. You have to confront it head on. We actually end up going back and forth a little bit on this because I thought about this, where if you always lead with confrontation, things might not go too well and you might be seen as a bit of a difficult person. But we actually end up talking about relationships and standards that we set for when we're dating somebody new for the first time. And whether that's the time it takes us to reply or how much we communicate when we're at work or when we're on a night out, or even if it's what we post on social media or what we like and follow and engage with on social media and how respectful that is to our partners. If we set those boundaries early, it's much easier for it not to become an issue further down the line. One of the examples we talked about was I hosted a dating coach called Dr. Taylor Burrows, and she's a big believer that men and women who are in relationships shouldn't be liking scantily clad photos of the opposite sex on Instagram or social media because she thinks it's disrespectful. If that was something that you laid out as something that you think is the case early on in a relationship before things have even started, it's much easier to have that fight early than to maybe throw it in somebody's face 3 months into a relationship as when you've maybe had a fallout about something else. Oh, and I can't believe you liked such and such a photo. That is a real issue and it happens an awful lot of the time. So you can build this lesson out to fight up front into any domain and ultimately encourage you to set your standards early, be clear, communicate effectively what you will and will not tolerate, and also find out what the other person cares about as well. I use it in a work environment all the time, whether that's internal or external. So I'll say to my customers, I want you to be really clear where we stand with each other. I want to form a social contract based on the kind of expected behaviors that we both have. And if that's broken, the consequences of that are really, really clear. So fighting up front will save you a lot of hassle down the line and a lot of wasted time as well with people that you maybe don't want to spend time with. Next lesson is a double whammy on all things communication from Celeste Headlee. This was probably one of the first episodes where I managed to get a best-selling author on the podcast, episode 50-something. And it was so exciting because I'd watched Celeste's TED Talk called 10 Ways to Have Better Conversations. It had 12 million views, and I must have been at least 30 of those views over the few years, because I really, really think having good conversations and being a podcast host go hand in hand, but that applies to every area of life. And there were some assumptions that Celeste challenge. So a lot of people would assume that having a good conversation is being a good conversationalist, is speaking, but that's not the case, because number 9 in Celeste 10 ways is listen more. If your mouth is open, you're not listening. And you can use other phrases like you've got two ears and one mouth for a reason. But listening is fundamental to what we do, because firstly, it's a vital way to build connection and understanding. And secondly, because it's done so badly day to day, you actually will stand out by just being competent. And to listen well will set you apart from so many others. And my guests that I've interviewed over the last few years have appreciated my ability to listen, and they've either shared more, they've gone more into depth, they've been able to open up more, they've shared new insights that they haven't before, because I've given them the space to do that. And you'll find this in your own life too. If you work on your listening as a skill, it's actually a really tangible way to level up your communication, and people will share far more with you and you'll feel a much greater connection. The second biggest takeaway that I had from my episode with Celeste was a combination of both speaking and listening. And this actually came as a bit of a surprise to me as well. And it was the sixth way that she named, and that was don't equate your experience with theirs. I always thought if somebody was pouring their heart out to you about experience they were going through, you sharing something that relates to them would build a deeper connection. But Celeste explained to me that it's actually not helpful. So by you trying to relay a similar situation when somebody's going through a hard time, it's actually more helpful for you to just listen, absorb, and give them space. Take it all in and be a willing ear. To reply and think that you're necessarily being empathetic can be unhelpful, because it turns the spotlight onto you. And I really made some changes off the back of this to deal with the way that I would speak to somebody that's maybe telling me about a challenging time that they're going through. Because when I speak after listening to them, it's only to acknowledge or encourage or allow them to explore further. I'll nod along, I'll let them know that they can share more if they'd like to, I'll create a space for them. And it's only if somebody asks from my own experience of something similar that I would share it and put it forward. But until then, I purely allow them to share their experience and let them talk through it without any judgment or without me trying to relate too hard. Because ultimately, somebody may be dealing with something that we don't have anything relatable to say, and trying to find something to say to that is really, really not helpful. Next lesson is another one about communication, and it's more about self-awareness, and that's from best-selling author Thomas Erickson, who wrote Surrounded by Idiots. And he provides a method for assessing behaviors and preferences of people that we communicate with. And this method has really helped me both in my podcasting, but also my personal life and my work life as well, to collaborate better with others and communicate more clearly. He shared some data from a psychologist called Tasha Urix, and I probably butchered her name, that 95% of people they surveyed thought they had good self-awareness, but when they did the testing, only 10 to 15% had what they would deem good self-awareness. So it's important to establish that your existing behaviors and your current personality traits are a starting point for how you're going to communicate. And your behaviors ultimately will come from your predispositions, which are formed from a combination of your heritage, your environment, your upbringing, and just your socialization. And a notable amount will come from your parents as well, although Thomas said that it's roughly just about 50%, no more than that. In terms of what he shared was that at 24 to 25 years of age, individuals tend to not develop their personalities much more. So a lot of what we experience in those early years are what shape us. Now that's debated by lots of different psychologists, but for the purposes of this, we'll talk about what Thomas talked about, which was the DISC personality model. And that was breaking down our behaviors and character traits by four colors: red, yellow, green, and blue. Red was for dominance, yellow was for inspiration, green was for stability, and blue was for analytical behavior. Now, the first divide between these colors is down the middle, which is by extroversion versus introversion. So red and yellow are typically extroverted, while green and blue are more introverted. Now, I'm going to break down the colors in a little bit more detail, so bear with me. Reds are very goal-orientated and competitive. They achieve results, and that's their number one aim. They've got a problem with telling the They've no problem with telling the truth and being direct. Some people might describe them as bullish or even aggressive. Yellows, again another extroverted one, are open, they're happy, they're positive, and they see opportunities where others see problems. They enjoy life and they're always looking for a good time. Others may see them as being too talkative and as not taking things seriously enough. Greens are more friendly, they're calm, they're caring, and they're sharing. They're the best listeners and they give the most space. They also take care of others and they strive for good team cooperation. Others, negatively, can sometimes view greens as imprecise, dishonest, and too conflict-avert and shy. Blues are more detail orientated, and these are the data guys. They focus on facts and proof, and they deal really in the fundamentals of things. They strive for perfection and high quality in everything, and some people consider them to be a bit dry, stone-faced, boring, or too stuck in their Excel spreadsheets. Now, I actually did the dispersonality test through two corporate jobs that I've had over the years, and they really helped me better understand myself. And I actually nodded along pretty strongly with my strengths, things like action taker, analytical, determined, direct and honest, really what you would call red blue. But I also kind of flinched a little bit when I acknowledged some of my potential flaws, and that is that I can be a bit relentless and a bit intense. I can be like a bull in a china shop to achieve my goal, and that can actually hurt others' feelings as well. Seeing those written down and analysed really helped my self-awareness of how I deal with others around me. And two of my favourite quotes that Thomas shared were, "The stronger your self-understanding is, the greater your probability of adapting to the people around you." And I really have a grasp of that now, because some of the feedback that I had can be a bit sore, but you'll see why some friendships that you've had before, some relationships you've had before, or even some work dynamics before haven't worked because you've been butting heads with different communication styles and only been thinking about you. And I didn't tailor my style to how the other person wanted me to be. And don't get me wrong, of course, there's merit in the potentially them mellowing their style, but it's important to be the bigger man in that circumstance and try and mold yours. The second quote that Thomas shared, and the last thing that I'll share on this subject, is by adjusting yourself to how other people want to be treated, you become more effective in your communication. That's not to say that you become a chameleon and you become a flake and you become like a tree blowing in the wind with no spine, but you must, while staying true to yourself, understand thoroughly how somebody would like to be spoken to and try and speak to them on that basis at times that matter. Okay, next lesson, and this is more about brain chemistry, so we're going to get a bit deep here, but you're going to enjoy this because it's all actionable too. And it's from TJ Power, the British neuroscientist. Now, TJ is somebody that's extremely practical, but from a brain chemistry perspective, we talked about four hormones, and that's talking about getting the right dose. And dose stands for dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, and endorphins. All of these are hormones that go inside of our brain, which impact our mental health, how we feel, how we operate on a day-to-day basis. And the empowering thing that TJ shared is that we have a lot of lifestyle control over how these hormones respond. So for dopamine, for example, what you could do is understand that it's the effort hormone, not necessarily the pleasure hormone, and it could involve you boosting it by tidying your room or making your bed, maybe tick off that admin that you've been putting off and you know that you've been delaying. You could exercise in a way that you find challenging or enjoyable, or many of you know that I quite like a cold dip, or you could do a cold shower and that'll release dopamine as well because you're making an effort and on the other side of it is some sort of reward. For oxytocin, the way to boost that naturally, you could socialize with friends, ideally without your phone, and try and be present. You could hug a friend or family member. Touch is very, very important for oxytocin. Or you could do an act of kindness for somebody close to you and feel the benefits of doing something for somebody else. Serotonin release, nature is very important for that, and also movement. So walking outside for 30 minutes is a big way to do that. There's a number of foods that involve that, and by you preparing that food can also have an impact on your hormones too. So it could be things like eggs, turkey and chicken apparently have quite a lot of serotonin, and even nuts as well. For endorphins, number one way that TJ called out was to sing or dance to music. And I really know that I have particular songs that I'll put on in the shower and I just feel much better when I come out after off the back of that. Laughter is a big part of endorphins as well. So watching comedy or even doing relatively strenuous, challenging exercise will release a lot of endorphins as well. And anyone that's trained for any period of time will know that as well. So those are the big ones for moving forward when it comes to dose. And I really believe, and this is kind of an Andrew Huberman thing / TJ Power thing, the mind will follow what the body does. And by having these actionable ways to boost these areas that we maybe feel at times that we're deficient in, that's great. Because if you have empowerment over how you feel and how you operate, that can only be a good thing. And one of the most recent episodes, I think episode 246, was Dr. Meg J. And she's pushing back that many people are self-diagnosing themselves online with mental health conditions, mental health disorders. And she really believes that many of the people that are diagnosing themselves via TikTok if they looked at their lifestyle design and developed some of the skills, in fact, she actually puts 10 forward in her book, and I think we discussed 5 or 6 of them on the episode, by equipping yourself with these skills, you actually have much more control over how you feel. And I think that's something that anyone that listens to a podcast like this one will benefit from. Next up, and we're into our kind of final batch of lessons, is one from Ross Harkness, who is a peak performance and personal branding master. And the big concept that Ross specializes in is self-mastery. And he packages it up into 3 areas of self-mastery. And it's a term that's really crept into my language. You'll hear me talk about mastery in sales or mastery in podcasting. And there's 3 areas to that. The first of those is self-mastery of the mind, self-mastery of actions, and the last one is self-mastery of craft. And it's craft that I want to talk about just now, because it's so important finding what your life's work and activities and efforts are going to be. So finding your mission and how you're going to spend your time is something that's fundamental. And I know there's been a lot of people that rally against things like, oh, you aren't your job and don't identify as your business or your career. But when you spend so much time doing something, there is a case for you to understand, why am I dedicating so much time to this? It should be something that has a positive feedback loop for you and gives you some sort of feeling or reward. And Ross uses a really specific process for understanding what your craft should be in the first place, and then how to pursue mastery in it. And the first part of that process is called life tapping, which is when you get absolutely clear on what your dream day or dream activity would look like, whether that's work, socializing, the location you're in, the activities you do, the stimulus you have, the people you spend time with. And that's not necessarily like a vision board or a utopia that you're aiming towards in terms of possessions or anything like that, but it's a more immediate day plan of how that might look. Ross gave the example that he actually started a social media marketing agency, and he realized that as somebody who's quite introverted, he actually hated doing the calls, and he wasn't that interested in the intricacies of targeting or pixelating or whatever else comes up in a marketing perspective. Instead, he found that he really enjoys reading, he really enjoys writing. The topics he loves are productivity, mastery and fulfillment, and purpose. That meant that he had something that he could really focus clearly on what a good day looked like him. A good day looked like for him. So good day would be things like waking up and reading, taking down the notes that he's learned, writing that down for his newsletter, turn that into the ways that he could teach on to others, the people that are feeling a bit lost, and he could help them. So by life tapping, he mapped out exactly what he liked in his day, and he also mapped out what hell or what he didn't like looked like as well, and that was spending lots of time on calls. For me, when you're life tapping, you need to go into real detail. You need to write that down, and you need to identify what your why is within that as well. So when you're starting to build out the activities you like to do, it'll quite quickly become clear that you want to build either more wealth, or you want to build more freedom, or you want to build more time. And beyond that, you can start to quickly match that up to whether those activities move you in that direction. And the second exercise that Ross advocates for is called conscious alignment. And that's where you review every decision that you make and the activity that you do, and you put a question above it: does this move me in the direction I want to go in? Remember when I was talking earlier about the identity you have with your phone use? If I reach for my phone right now, is it moving me closer to where I want to be? So for example, if I don't send this cold email, will I get closer to my sales target? From a dieting and a health and fitness perspective, if I have this cookie, if I drink this sugary tea, is it moving me forward to the body goal that I've set and the time limit that I've given myself to do it? Is blocking out 20 minutes for role-playing my presentation for tomorrow, is that going to help me win the client? All these questions allow us to think about, are we moving in the right direction? Are we consciously aligned with where we want to get towards? And this whole process of self-mastery reminds me of one of my favorite and one of my most popular guests, Sahil Bloom. He spoke about the zone of genius. And I really believe that if you can find your zone of genius, which in theory is where your interests, your passions, and your skills all align, then when you spend time operating in your zone of genius, it means that you play games that you're uniquely well suited to playing and that don't exhaust you all the time. Because once you identify what your zone of genius is, you stop playing the games of others and you start playing games of yours. And that is something that you all want to work towards: having self-mastery in a craft that feels great to you. And that reminds me of a lesson that I want to talk about that comes specifically from Sahil Bloom, and that is regarding energy calendars, and that's how to best identify how you spend your time. So with an energy calendar, what you do is you write out everything you've done. You're in bed at night, you write out your calendar that you've done during the day, and you review it, and you color code the activities. So red would mean that you felt drained afterwards, yellow would mean you felt pretty neutral, and green would feel like you gave you more energy. And in a week, you're quite clearly going to see across your calendar the activities that you do that aid things and the activities that you do that take away from you. And by batching energy draining tasks in specific times or windows that you're going to perform them best. So for example, if I'm doing CRM uploads to our system about the calls and the meetings that I've had this week, I find that really boring and really draining. But I do it first thing on a Friday morning before I make my outbound calls because I'm looking forward to my outbound calls. But I hate doing the draining stuff before it, but I know I need to do it to get to the fun stuff that I really enjoy. Equally, you can also cut things out. Now, this is not a position of privilege that everyone's in, but I didn't really enjoy doing my meal prep on a Sunday. Guess what? I get my meal sent to me every single Monday by Clean Foods. That's really important to me. Equally, you might find that you love that time when you're cooking and you listen to a podcast or you do something during it and that gets colored green for you. You might want to do more cooking. You might want to do more meal prep. Whatever that is, start to identify in your calendar the things that give you energy, the things that you're good at, and that can link back into the other things that we're talking about when Ross is talking about life tapping, mapping out what life might want to look like. You want to have more greens on your calendar and less red. Now, the final lesson that I want to share with you, and I couldn't do this podcast without bringing it up, is the episode I did with Richard Dixon, the first one round, episode 140. And Richard was somebody that explained to me that you cannot be everything to everyone, and you actually need to lean into who you are and be completely comfortable with that. In his early days as an entrepreneur, Richard really divided his audience. He polarized those who agreed with him, liked his style, liked his stances, liked his attitude, while others were put off and they actively seemed to be angry with how he conducted himself, how he held himself, what he talked about, what his ideas were. Importantly, he wasn't trying to appeal to everyone. He was really heavily influenced in the early days by Grant Cardone, who was very happy to have people on the internet who hate his guts, but he has a tribe of people who want to work with him within 10x and want to support him. And Richard did that as well. He really detached from the process of focusing on being liked by the masses. Instead, he built a core audience of people who really liked him, really appreciated him, and really wanted to work with him. And that core audience grew in size as well. And I think that's been the case with the podcast. If you look at the way that episode performed, for example, Richard's got a good size of audience who all really, really like him. They shared the episode, they pushed it on to friends, they got it out there. Because when that episode was out there, his audience were so enthusiastic about it. And it's one of the most played episodes that I've got. But Richard doesn't have the biggest audience of people that I've had on. I mentioned Sahil Bloom. It's probably got half the plays that Richard's got, but it's still a popular episode. But he's got a million followers on Twitter and I don't know, however many hundred thousand on Instagram. Having a core audience who really vibe with you is so, so important. And on a personal level, I've learned more about this over time. That episode was recorded in August 2022. And since then, I've realized that some people are never going to like what I talk about when it comes to growth and self-development. They're going to get triggered. They're just never going to vibe with me. And I'm never going to appease those people, and nor should I want to appease them. Because if you talk about mastering your body and your habits and focusing on fat loss, you might get called fat phobic. You might get called that you're anti-self-love. If you're talking about money, you're told that you're materialistic or hateful. And again, the types of people that don't like that content, they're never going to buy into the narrative that I'm putting forward. They're never going to listen to my podcast. So I shouldn't even try to appease them. I shouldn't even try and meet their quota, meet their level of content that they're looking for. So I'd much rather create content as me, follow my curiosities, follow my interests, produce the type of podcast that I would want to listen to as a younger me or even as a future me, and understand that some people will never like that. They're never going to be involved. In fact, they're going to be critical. Best believe when I look at some of the TikTok comments, my goodness, people get so, so annoyed. But I'm not going to bend my criteria to meet theirs, and I'm not going to lose myself along that process. And funnily enough, one of the things that I've mentioned Chris Williamson already, he said in episode one that the persona is incapable of receiving love. So if you play a role and try to be somebody to get praise and to get adulation and to get support, it feels hollow, but For me, if I act as myself on this podcast and I bring myself to each conversation and I have true conversations and I act in alignment with who I am, when I get a message saying that was an amazing episode, it feels deserved and it feels earned, and that is so much more wholesome than chasing something that is just an act. So I could, and I've joked before, I could just interview loads of gangsters on the podcast and get loads of downloads and loads of plays. But if somebody was like, oh, that was a great episode with whoever it was, I wouldn't feel anything because I've done it only for one motive, to grow the audience. And that's not particularly correct, and it wouldn't make me feel good. So as we wrap up this episode, this special episode where I've talked about the lessons over the last 250, I think I want you to take the time to ask yourself, what do you really want to create for your life? What is the ideal version that you're aiming at? What are the unique strengths that you have, that only you have, that you can lean into? And what do you think that might mean for what you like in your day, what you don't like in your day? And ultimately understand that that will mean that you're accepted by some people and not accepted by others. I've taken the time to write down an awful lot of lessons, but I think we've covered just about enough for today. If you're somebody that would like to hear more lessons from the podcast in the last 4 years of recording, then please do DM me. I've got something special written down, drafted up, that I can share with you as well. I am so thankful for the direction the podcast going in. Thank you so much for your support. 250 episodes in, and we're not slowing down anytime soon. I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very soon.